Welcome to the Marshall Pruitt Podcast, presented by Cooper Tires and supported this month by Bell Racing Helmets USA. We have a fun little feature here with the next generation IndyCar stars here at the Indy 500. We sat down for a little roundtable at Bell's brand new, beautiful Main Street shop with Spencer Pigott from Ed Carpenter Racing, qualified within the Fast 9 for the Indy 500. Sat down with Jack Harvey with the Meyer Shank Racing Team, and also with Kyle Kaiser with Hunkos Racing. Impressive as well. Sitting across from those three young guns, we had one of the old guns, Al Unser Jr., two-time Indy 500 winner. Fun little conversation about getting ready for this race. Al passing on some wisdom from his experiences at the Speedway. Some cool conversation as well about the history and lineage of Bell, and not only what it means to the young drivers, but also to Al, who says he was genuinely a kid the first time he started using Bell. Some tech talk in there as well about turbo days and how helmets actually played a role in engine performance. It might sound crazy now, but it's true. And we close, and I'm not going to preview this much other than to say we thought we were done. I was doing my usual little throwaway nonsense, silly, whatever, ha-ha. And the topic of ham and cheese sandwiches, Porsche 962s, and motor racing comes up. And all I can tell you is when we get to the end, I'm still blown away by the awesome, awesome story that was shared with us. And it's little gems like this that occur when friends like Bell Racing Helmet say, hey, we're going to pull some folks together. Come on over. Let's do a podcast here. So, yeah, great, great stuff there. You know, you can get every episode of the Marshall Pruitt Podcast on iTunes, on Podbean, and also on our Marshall Pruitt Podcast Facebook page. And with all that said, off we go with our Bell Racing Helmets USA roundtable at their Speedway Indiana Pro Shop.
All right. Well, we have a man with a couple of faces from the Indy 500 Borg Warner Trophy. Beautiful ring there. Have you shown our guests what an Indy 500 winner's ring looks like? We have Al Unser Jr., Jack Harvey, Spencer Pigott, and Kyle Kaiser currently drooling over one of Little Al's Indy 500 winning rings.
That's the 94. That's really cool. So
the beast.
Yeah. It was a good day.
I bet.
So we are here today in the Bell Racing Helmets USA shop, their new home here on Main Street, the garage, air conditioning overhead, ambient. So we're not sitting in a booth with perfect audio, but you know what? Our lives are rarely spent in quiet booths, so this is kind of perfect. Thought it'd be great to sit down here. We have Ron Schumann's old school helmet in front of us, which weighs 47 pounds. We have a replica, Al, of your 1994 winning helmet, which weighs nothing by comparison. Just thought it'd be fun to get one of the old masters here together with some of the young guns who... Did you give back the ring? I'm just making sure. They didn't
yes,
pocket that?
Yes, I they made want, sure they gave back the ring.
They want one or more. Let's start off with you, Spence, because you're someone who has been on this path in IndyCar a little longer than some of the other young guns. Team did incredibly well in qualifying as a whole, making the Fast 9. Give us some thoughts about just where you are career progression-wise. Again, at least looking across the table to someone, you're like, that's the destination.
That's the destination I want it. I want to go to that destination. Hopefully I get there one day. but yeah, I mean, so far this month has been great. We've got three fast cars. You know, we've shown that in qualifying trim, I think in race trim as well. We should be competitive, and it's going to be tough though. Obviously there's a lot of fast cars, a lot of good teams, and you know, it's the Indy 500, so anything can happen. It's a long race, but I'm very happy with where we are on the preferred freezer car, starting sixth. It's by far the best starting position I've had here at Indy, so you know, it's going to be nice to only have a couple cars in front rather than the majority of the field.
You've told your boss who's on the pole, Ed Carpenter, that you're just move over at the start you're coming by?
Something like that, yeah. Okay. Not quite those words. But.
Or there might have been a please and let me know if I can help you. So you with your Ed Carpenter Racing Chevy team, obviously a great day with all three cars in the Fast 9. move to Kyle Kaiser and the Juncos Racing Chevy. Very unique in this field, Al, where we don't have much in the way of single car teams, and we've got a team coming back for their second time with a rookie driver, two lights champions here, but three car, really strong team with Spencer's team. And then you've got Kyle, where, you know, there are some folks asking, are they even going to be in the show? You gave them the virtual middle finger and said, we're going to be damn far up in the show to start. Tell us just about how your month has gone and maybe, you know, punching well above the weight we expected.
Yeah, it's been a crazy month. I mean, starting off the first week, we were just focusing on qualifying because we knew we had to make the show. And we struggled a little bit, to be honest. We weren't 100% sure going into the week what we had. And literally the night before bump day, we tried something in the very last run, last session, and it made the car a mile an hour faster, and we were just shocked. So we're like, okay, we'll roll with that for qualifying, and hopefully it's got pace. And the Chevy engine had a lot of pace, so I was just thrilled. I saw the lap time, and I couldn't believe it. I just kept it flat and said, thank God. So it was a really good feeling to see that. And I knew we were pretty comfortable at that time, but since then, I've just been much more relaxed, much happier. There's been great morale of the team. Everybody's having a lot of fun now, and that's what this month's all about.
Amen. Jack, you've had a different experience so far this month. At least when I was a mechanic, I would always refer to it as the long walk to grid,
yes,
where you know you're going to get in your steps, getting to your starting position, whereas these two friends obviously have had happier times. Tell us about the experience as a young driver, trying to keep your morale up, trying to keep the team up, while knowing that if you could have had that extra mile an hour given it to him, he would have appreciated
it. Yeah,
you know,
a
little greedy there, Kaiser, but we'll talk privately.
I mean, it's
but tell us about when things aren't going the way you envisioned.
Yeah, I think as a whole, I'm listening to these two guys, I'm thinking, yeah, that sounds pretty awesome and exactly not what I'm dealing with right now. Whatever that change was for a mile an hour, we want it. It's been a really challenging month, I think, for the Meyer Shank Racing team, and honestly, Schmidt-Peterson Motorsports. I mean, the morale has not been great for obvious reasons. James didn't make the race. You know, bump day is a real thing. So when you were saying at the start of the month that, you know, you don't really know what you've got, I mean, that stresses to everybody.
Yeah.
I mean, I honestly didn't think we would be that much on the bubble. And I saw my first lap, and like you was like, that's what, well, you were happy with your speed. And I looked at him and thought, really? That's all we've got? And the race has been pretty good, honestly. I think I've been pretty happy race winning wise, but in terms of qualifying, I can't complain with the balance of the car. Balance is good. We just didn't have it, honestly. I think what happened to James, the knock-on effect of that has rubbed, you know, to every nook and cranny of the team. I think ultimately we had a big team meeting. It was a case of, okay, well, we've still got three cars in the show. Let's try and end the month on as positive note as possible. And I mean, we are optimistic with our race car, but we certainly made it a little bit harder work than we would have hoped. So starting 31st. So
Al, we started out speaking about your greatest days at Indy. Defending Indy 500 winner. You come back in 1995. It's going to be a breeze, right? Pick up another ring, right? Get the trophy ready. Get that mug ready to go. You know, so listening to these guys, you had all of their experiences together. What can you tell someone like Jack, who fortunately you're in the race, but you know, you're going to have a long way to go. What do you have to say to someone like Jack when you know what it's like to go from the highs to the lowest of lows?
Yeah, I was just thinking about that as I was listening to everybody. You know, I won the race in 94, came back in 95, and missed the show. So it was from one extreme to the other. And honestly, at Penske Racing, we were in disbelief, you know, in 95. I mean, you know, you never come to Indy and think that you're going to drink the milk and it's just going to be a breeze.
Ooh.
Okay, Marshall? Yeah. So that never, ever happens. We never thought that we would not be racing the Indy 500, and so when that happened, it was devastating. But you know, for all the years that I have run Indy, you know, no matter where you're starting, it's the finish that's important. And so for each one of you. I mean, it's taking care of your equipment, especially at the start, you know, the first few laps. I mean, you got a whole race in front of you, and so, you know, there's going to be huge temptations to go up there and stick it in, and especially starting 31st, which I started in the back quite a few times. Those holes open, what we call, you know, the opportunity shows up, and it's only for one or two cars, and you're in the back like that, and at the beginning of the race, you have to be careful not to go up in there because it closes just as fast as it opens. And so, you know, just to get the race started and get it going. And, you know, I remember my dad won in 87, and he started in the back with me, but there was an accident in turn one. Fortunately, it was just behind me, but it was in front of my dad. And you know, he admits that he took it too easy at the beginning of the race, and he got a lap down almost right away, and he had to fight hard to get that back and that sort of thing. But he ends up winning the race. And so you just never know which way this thing's going to go. You never know who's going to be running at the end and who's not going to be running at the end. And so, you know, this is a place that that patience is the key to this whole thing. And try and invest and doing it, and hopefully you're around at the end. And if you are, each one of you has an equal shot as Ed Carpenter, as all the Penske cars. You know, everybody starting up front. You all have an equal opportunity to win this thing.
Let's talk about another topic before we get into a little bit of the shared Bell helmet histories with everyone here. We're expecting things to be warm at minimum on Sunday, if not sweaty, balls hot. You've experienced that, Al, but you've also experienced a crazy day like 92, where it was far colder than expected. The end result was about the same, though, whether it was a byproduct of heat or not enough heat, cars that just were moving beneath you the whole time, not planted. This crazy guy, again, of course, wins the Indy 500 in those circumstances as well. Tell us a little bit about going into a race where you know you're not going to be glued and happy and planted, and you're going to have to spend a couple hours of your life holding on to a beast that either wants to get out from under you or get into the wall, because I fear this might be their reality come, and everyone's reality come Sunday. What's the mindset you need to deal with that?
Well, the mindset is simple. Just drive what the car is going to allow you to do. You know, I mean, it's that simple.
No heroics?
No. You start doing heroics, and you'll be out of the race like as quick as you're in it. I mean, it's that fast. And so I think these guys have a unique challenge. Me working with Harding Racing and working with Gabby, you know, we've run max downforce, and we want more, okay?
I think everyone would raise their hand on that one.
But we're max. I mean, and so when I was racing, there was no limit that, you know, we could put a bunch of downforce in the car, a bunch, you know, where it would be glued no matter how hot it was, but you'd be super slow down the straightaway. So,
except for 94 when you had more than 1,000 horsepower. But that was an exception.
But yeah,
I've never did that.
That was an anomaly.
Yeah. Okay?
That was a real. But in today's car, I mean, we're running max, and we wanted more. And so, like for example, a wicker bill on the rear wing is not allowed.
Yep.
You know, and you can only have so big and so long of wickers on the front wings, and so you can't go above that. And for an 85 to 90 degree day, on Sunday was what they were predicting. Man, I wished I had more grip. You know, and these guys are gonna want. They're gonna wish they had. And so. So, you know, they're just going to have to be able to drive what the car is going to allow them to do. and that's going to be the key.
Spence, let's talk about that. Monday, obviously, we had a couple hours of race simulation, some pretty good trains going on there. We'll get an hour's look tomorrow on carb day, but how close were you able to get into that comfort zone? Were you reminded after, like, God, I got fast hands, because otherwise, you know, this thing would be in a bundle. What did you find?
Yeah, definitely, you know, throughout a run, it can go from understeering sometime to oversteering in certain corners, and there's not really a great, you know, you can't really predict it sometimes.
It's not telegraphing what's coming.
Yeah, exactly. You can't just bank on it always doing one thing throughout the run. So I think you have to, you know, just take, like Al said, take what it gives you, but also don't get too freaked out. If you do have a little snap or little moment, you know, you can't let that kind of knock down your confidence, because it's going to happen throughout the race, and hopefully it's not so big, but, you know, you're going to have to be able to drive the car in both situations. And for us, we had, I think, a few good runs, a few not so good runs. It seems to be very easy to kind of tip it over one way or the other. So, you know, it's going to be a fine line of really getting the car just in the right window, I think. You know, throughout the race, you have the little things you can change about with the front wing. But, you know, the rear wing, like Al said, it's probably going to be maxed out for everyone the whole time. And just trying to tune it in throughout the race, you've got a few tools in the car, but you know, you want to make sure you start the race with the car in a good window, because if you're out of the window, you know, it might not be able to get back in it.
Jack, let's continue that thread with your Meyer Shank Racing Honda. So to the average fan watching, they're not going to see you doing big Tokyo drifts through the corners. I'm going, oh, now I get what he's talking about,
if
right?
If he does, it'll be a one and done.
Well, if they do, you'll be on SportsCenter, and we'll be seeing you in the
Danny
infield.
Danny Sullivan in 85.
Right, well, we'll see if we can get the old man back in the car.
I don't want to do that.
That's fair enough.
No one wants to do that, okay?
I'm certainly happy that someone else do that heroic spin.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
But speak, Jack, to the fact that, again, although this isn't something huge and demonstrative that fans can see, whether they have binoculars or they have super high-speed eyeballs or they can do things in slow speed, tell us about what you are having to do in the car in the average lap to keep it pointed in the direction you want.
I think, first off, it depends on your balance for sure. If you've got understeer, typically you see someone turn the wheel more. I mean, it sounds goofy to say, but literally is that simple, you just turn more.
But that's something for fans to watch if they get an in-car camera shot, usually from the right side mirror. Just one of those things, if you want to get a feel,
sure,
you know, you don't have to be a race car driver to know what it's like, but if you see a driver's hand starting to get higher on that shot, you know that they're dealing with understeer.
No, the thing that's interesting is when your car is what we would call free, actually your hands almost like barely turn the wheel. And that's probably when you're looking at someone in the most vulnerable state, because, you know, if you quicken the speed in which you do that turn, you can end up in a whole world of trouble. I mean, I don't know if anybody saw James Davidson's crash in turn two, but, like, by the time you've realized that you've got that free, you're already spinning.
Yeah.
You know, like, the time in which you think you've got an issue and then you know you've got an issue, you're already stopped pretty much, because you've already hit the wall and then your car's come to a complete stop. And I think it's just a real interesting thing where if you're watching from an onboard camera, typically it's safer when you're seeing somebody adding in a bunch of wheel. When they're barely turning the wheel, they're so free, they don't want to turn the wheel anymore. And
if the right hand is up, somewhat safety
zone,
straight, or the left hand's up, start your prayers.
It's all gone wrong, mate. And honestly, it is, the time in which it goes wrong is the blink of an eye. Because you're watching James earlier, and you're like, okay, you know, looks good through one, no like initial, no big issue. Gets to two, turns in, and then just, and he's gone. He looked like he was barely turning the wheel. I mean, it's not a, the people who are not turning the wheel, they're the ones who are stressing out, I think, as much as the people who are doing it.
Ooh. Kyle, let's close on this thread when it comes to working with your team. So as Al said, and I think as everyone has agreed, please give us 500 more pounds of downforce something, but it's not there to get. How do you game plan with your team, with your engineer, going into the race to say, okay, if things are going slightly awry, what are my options to at least get me to a place of comfort?
Yeah, I'm very fortunate to have somebody with as much experience as Tom has, Tom Brown, because there's been moments where we don't know what's going on and we had to really go back to the drawing board and figure stuff out. But like Al said, patience, not just in reference to the race, but setting up this car. Because if we go down a wrong path and we get frustrated, you might not be able to get out of that hole. So we were patient, we waited, we kept trying stuff, and we just were persistent. And I think that persistence, eventually we found the right answer. There was no guarantee we were going to find it. You can see there are plenty of really strong teams that couldn't find the answer because this new car has made it so difficult. But just we made a right decision and it worked out, but we were persistent.
You have a heck of a history with this company. Let's talk about finding the right helmet for that glorious head of yours, Al. The tale is it took a little while to find a place of happiness and exactly what was right, but I always think it's cool, and obviously we're here courtesy of our friends at Bell Racing Helmets, but I just always find it a pretty cool thing when you have a driver who's had a long-term association with the brand. It doesn't mean necessarily things are perfect your first trial. What's it been like coming into the Bell family and finding that?
I don't know where you heard that, Marshall. I mean, once I put the Bell on, it was like home. I mean,
Our friends from Bell are laughing right now is perfectly fine.
I started, okay, Chris was, I was before him, okay? I had a Bell helmet in my go-kart when I was 9, 10, 11 years old. Okay, so I've been a Bell guy for a very, very long time before Chris.
He's like 140 years old.
So,
but let's talk about the weight of that. First of all, that's the thing I want to know. I'm guessing
it was pretty heavy.
Yeah,
it was pretty heavy.
You built your neck muscles early back then.
Well, that and the sprint car, you know, you had to. It was just the times and so on. I mean, you know. In that day, Bell made the lightest helmet that existed, and today they do the same thing. And so they've always led in the technology, no matter what era you're in. Bell has always been have given me the ultimate in head safety and that sort of thing that can be available. And so. And on top of that, they're comfortable, you know? I mean, if anything, I have a little bit of a weird-shaped forehead, okay?
I live a misshapen life, Al, so you're preaching to the choir here.
So when I would put on, you know, my Bell, it was the only thing, some of them were a little bit tight on the forehead, and so I would have to have them sand out the forehead a little bit, and really that was about it. I mean, We did a lot of things. We developed the little cover that goes underneath my chin.
Yeah.
Because I caught fire in Cleveland one day, in the pits, and the fire came up through underneath the helmet because it was a fueling mishap and the fuel spilled over on my lap and in my chest, and then when it lit up down here and the flame came up. And it burned my nose a little bit, you know, nothing big at all.
Nothing big. My face was on fire. Nothing big.
It wasn't. I don't have any scars or nothing. Come on. And so,
that's what men were meant for. Everyone's truest statement was just that. Fire in my helmet, but it wasn't big.
Well, it wasn't. As a matter of fact, I get out of the car, and actually my left front, Ziggy, okay, was my left front, Paul Harkus. He was, and he got burned, and he got burned pretty good, and he got burned in his nads.
Oh,
I mean,
he's so ugly we couldn't tell.
So anyway, the fire happened right at the beginning of the stop, and so buckets of water came on, everybody's put out, you know. I was leading the race when I came in the pits to make the pit stop, and so now the fire's out, everything's good, and I'm looking at my car, and it's perfectly fine. So Rick Gallus is my car owner. I say, Rick, let's go. Let's get back in the race. And he goes, half your crew is burned.
Oh, jeez.
We could get you back out there, but we can't make any stops.
Do you want to change all your tires, too? Good
That's
Lord.
What Rick told me. And I go, okay, well, I guess we're out of the race. But,
wow.
But, no, so we developed that little fabric that goes underneath the chin. And when we did that, we discovered that you could hear, they could hear me on radio communications better. So it was like a double whammy.
Smart.
And so, you know, we've done some other things with the Bell. When I put in there that we had an extra fabric to go across my nose, okay, across the top, so that when it rained, I could put that fabric in there with a little nose piece that would pin it down, and then it'd keep my breath
and avoid fogging
by quite a lot. So, there's been a lot of innovations that I was a part of with Bell, but
I've told you before, just as a sidebar, your Bell during your Valvoline years, just that helmet livery itself, is one of the most beautiful things.
Yeah,
I've
it
seen
is. I, as a matter of fact, I keep it today. I use it today, and for myself, I never had a specific design for the helmet that would separate me from the race car. I always felt that the helmet should match the race car in every aspect, because I figured they know who's driving, you know.
If not, you need to go faster.
Yeah.
Make sure they know.
Exactly, that's right. So, you know, where you'd see the helmet that's sitting in front of you, it has the Marlboro chevron on it. Now, Rick Mears drove this pattern, this paint scheme. My father drove that paint scheme, and so I didn't really care, you know. And the Valvoline helmet, it delivery on it, it was to match the car, you know. And I had a black helmet when I was in the Coors Light black car.
Didn't you have a cue ball in your Eagle early on there too?
I did. It was pure white.
Yep.
with Gallus across the front. He really liked that. He was the car owner, and so he
loved name
that being
helmet.
Up there. And so.
Yeah.
I felt that it should match the car always.
So let's talk about one more retro piece before we talk to these guys about their preferences. So your replica 94 helmet doesn't have
this one right here doesn't have
the little wastegate, the little listening tube. Talk about that. These guys race twin turbo V6 engines from Chevy and Honda, but they don't have pop-off valves. You, on the other hand, did. Tell us about what this little helmet attachment did and why you would want it in the first place.
Well, in today's car, they're totally controlled electronically.
Yep.
You know, and so when we start talking about the pop-off valve, this is before electronics came into it. So I actually had a knob in the car that I could turn the boost up and down with mechanically. Okay, and so... In order to...
These guys I can see are going back and asking for that today.
So there was a limit, you know, and it was the pop-off valve. And it was a valve, little round valve that sat on top of the plenum. And as soon as we got so much boost in it, it would pop and the air would release. So they had a little tube connected to it on the, when it would pop up and it would blow the air. I'd come all the way through up the cockpit and into my helmet, and it would blow air on my cheek.
Oh my gosh.
And it was hot. It was hot air, okay? And so.
Now, would you get any audio, little pitch difference that it was about to blow? No.
You could just feel it. You could, it kind of go like that.
So that was a way of regulating boost limits. Since there was no electronic means, they would say that this was a maximum amount.
Right.
And since you could, through a cockpit knob or just the engine tuner being really aggressive, try and put a trillion pounds of boost through. Well, there was a limit. So the only way to regulate that was mechanically through, again, sitting on top of the turbo plenum, this tall kind of looked like a really big beer can with a spring inside of it. And once the turbo pressure exceeded that spring's limit, that spring would compress a little bit, the air would leak out, and you'd go from having 800 horsepower to nothing. Or, you know, if you let it go all the way, but that was the listening device to get
and
a feel for
turn it back down a little bit and so
yeah,
you didn't
you'd,
get
you'd
the,
close
yeah.
it. Yeah, you'd find out where the limit is and then you'd make sure it stayed closed. So
how much did you have to adjust that? Was it a constant thing?
No. Once you had it set, once everything warmed up, you know, at the beginning of the race it was a little bit difficult because the turbo produces more boost when it's hot. Okay, so when you first start the race and it's a cold turbo, then you would turn it up at the start of the race, and then you know, down the backstretch, it's popping and you're turning it back down and stuff like that. And so along with all the cars around you and stuff like that. And so, but it was the driver fully on controlled how much boost was in his car because the valve, it wasn't electronic. And so even in our, when telemetry came into our race cars, the pits couldn't do anything about it. Okay. Even if they did see the boost, telemetry wise, they couldn't do anything. It was the driver that controlled the whole thing. And so you just turn it right back down and run your race. Once everything got warmed up, it was pretty much set.
And the other fun thing too is those pop-off valves belong to the series. So you might figure out, get a feeling for how one is working for you in the third race of the year, but you're going to have a different one for the fourth. And everyone's arguing about, oh, mine's popping too early, and there's always back and forth.
Constant.
So,
I mean, even when my valve was a good valve, it was not a good valve. Okay? So you had to take it back and go, look, you need to make this a little stronger. And so you never had the same valve more than twice. You did start the weekend with a valve and pretty much end with it, but during the month of May, you would switch out several valves during practice and so on because they're humanly equal, okay? Yeah. Humanly possible equal. When you get out there and you start running, there were differences. And that truly was the flaw of the whole system is that there's guys that would get better valves on one day and those valves would go away and you'd come and you'd, man, I got a good valve. And you go run the next day and the thing pops early and you've got the same valve. And so you go, what the hell's going on? And you take it back and they go, oh, well, we needed to adjust it a little bit because it was a little too good.
Jeez.
Okay, and okay, well, now it's really bad. So, you know, it's a constant battle all every day, during the day. The guys, whenever the car wasn't running, the valve was taken back to USAC and said, we need a stronger valve. It was a constant situation.
So you know how much we talk about hating balance of performance in sports cars, and those engineers and team owners are always going to the tech shed and say, you've screwed. Well, this was IndyCar's version in the 80s and 90s.
Yeah.
So you guys are familiar with, when you put on your race suits, you have the cables and such already kind of wired in to connect to the car that then connects to your helmet. What do you think about your helmet also being connected to something in the back of the car as well that you're having to listen to and being in, you have to be your own data monitor. So you're turning and working all your controls, but you also kind of have one ear on what's going on. Does that sound a little crazy or give you even more appreciation for some of the old guard here?
Marshall, it was easy. Okay.
Come on, I'm trying to build them up, damn it.
That thing popped. Well, you knew it. You knew it.
So it was the air, not so much
the
noise.
You just feel the noise. Right.
I could see you, like, you know, being so caught up in the moment that you might not even feel it. Or I don't know. It depends how hard or how. Yeah. Because sometimes I don't even hear the guys, you know, I never have heard anyone in my whole career call the green flag. I know they do it, but I never hear it. I'm going way before that anyway, and I'm already trying to pass people or defend, and so.
Wheeler, are you going to coach
good
up as spotter
my
to talk
hero
a little bit?
Right there, nice.
That's right. All right. What about you, Jack? I mean, just the fact that you are having to do more than just be an athlete, but you're also having to at least keep an eye, because it wasn't just the fact that you get the burst there, but you also know as you're pulling revs and building boost, so you're getting, you know, somewhere towards the top of the rev range, that's more likely when something would come in. But just the thought of you're having to actively monitor your situation so you don't lose a ton of horsepower.
Well, I think the fact that it would essentially, I guess, like, burn you in like some way. You know, it was like heat on your face.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of things right now, you know, we don't have anything like that. It's not like we have something connected to the wheel where if you're having too much lock, it shocks you, you know.
Good idea.
You know, but that's the thing. Isn't
I'm going to call Jay Fry. Hold on just a sec.
There you go.
I mean, they're literally having something that basically, when it's getting to the edge, is like getting. So you're talking about, so I mean, right now, I mean, we have our bars, we have our weight jacket, you have someone telling the radio, and then you've got your spotters telling you, like, you know, what's going around, and then you're just trying to focus on your race, and suddenly something's blowing at you.
The motor's mad at you.
Yeah, the motor's not happy with you, and I guess it's just a. I just think it's like really cool that people did that, and it's like just here as a legend, having like probably like one sheet that's like a slightly darker shade, maybe because it's like been burnt for so many years. But
I just love that they integrated this into the helmets as well. So Jack,
it was you know, I just kind of reminded here that you know, we would be able to control our boost, turn the knob up and down, okay? We would turn it down for fuel mileage.
Sure.
Okay? With you guys, it's a knob on your steering wheel, and it's done with fuel and timing instead of boost.
Sure.
And so and boost, but it's done with a switch. So we're doing the same thing out there, we're just doing it differently. So, you know, the formula that these guys today is just different from the formula that I used to race, and my formula was a little bit different from my dad's era, okay? And so, but it's still just as hard. The fundamentals of winning the 500 are the same, and so it's just different.
It sounded super cool until you said it was easy, and I think we were all just a little disappointed because it sounded so cool.
Damn it, Al. Jack, let's stay with you and talk about generations. You had your beautiful Indy 500 helmet unveiling here, gorgeous airbrush art and such, matches your car and whatnot. And just before that, you were doing your best to stuff Ron Schumann's helmet on your head.
It was snug.
So let's just talk about this, guys. You obviously have a lot of personalization that you do. You know, you can come in here at the Main Street shop and get taken care of any time, but tell me about this beautiful thing here in front of you, Jack, and then trying on something that is smaller but heavier in Ron's helmet.
Yeah.
Good Lord. This is one thing where you're definitely thankful to be a race car driver in 2018.
For sure. I think that's one of the things I think people talk about has changed the most, and it's helmet safety.
Spencer's petting your helmet, by the way,
fine.
But that's okay.
He's fine. You can keep it. I tried it on, and honestly, it was like tight on my head, but there's no like flex in that thing. You know, it is rigid, and it is hard, and it is heavy. And I actually thought, as soon as I tried it on, my God, your like neck strength must have just been incredible back in these days. Because I mean, like the weight of this now versus like that is incredible. I know you've mentioned it. I mean, there's nothing to add really about how good a job Bell are doing, because they are, you know, industry leaders in what they're doing. I guess when I look at that, it would have been kind of like maybe a one size fits all, where now, I mean, we can get like extra cheek padding, we can get extra stuff on our forehead, on the back of the head, and, you know, what fits me might not fit Spencer or Kyle or, you know, Al now, if you wanted to try it. And, you know, there's different size shells, and it just seems like so many things are a little bit more customizable to keep you comfy, where that's what we're used to. And you know, even when my dad raced and he did some sprint car racing, I try on like his helmets and be like, you wore this? Like, it's like, it's not comfy. And he's like, that's what we have. That simple. It was like, well, if you wanted to go racing, you that's like you have your different brands and you chose your brand, and you just hoped you went with, honestly, back, I guess he said to me, you went with the people who just naturally fit your head better, you know? I mean, I think that still happens now, but I feel like everybody can, you know, cut a bit out here or add a bit in padding-wise that fits you, but I just look at that now and I just think that the first thing that comes to mind is the size of people's necks back in the day. They must have been, like, huge.
You didn't get in fights with most drivers back then.
No, because they were just real men.
Yeah, and here we have further proof of helmet safety, Salt Walther's road-tested 1973 helmet. Fortunately, I don't think the three of you have a helmet that looks anything like this after a crash, but, I mean, not trying to overstate the obvious, but if you had no idea who Salt Walther was, but knew that he was in the Indy 500 and this was his helmet tells the tale of how his day went.
Yeah.
Not very good.
Yes, this was one of the more, either that or one of the craziest liveries to start the race I've ever come across before.
It's a little
scratched up.
It's not second hand, it's fifth hand.
That's I got burnt. I mean, like in the nicest way. Seeing how helmets have developed now made me feel so much more comfortable with like what we're having to like deal with. Because I look at back there, and I do think it's when, you know, I say men were men, but people were just outright brave. You know, and I look at it now and go, okay, you're going 220, you know, plus I think everybody looks at it, everybody has an element of bravery. But that's real. You know, that was a very real scenario that somebody could get in. You know, in a time where motorsport wasn't as safe, was as dangerous, which wasn't as safe. So seeing what we get to deal with now, and not necessarily just because of the glitter and the sparkles on the helmet, but just knowing how safe they are, I think it's peace of mind for me anyway. My mum.
There is a lot of pink and a lot of sparkles on this helmet.
Yes. Yes.
It matches the car.
I thought Danica was referred to as Princess Sparkle Pony, but she is retiring. I might have a successor here.
What I see when I'm looking at your helmet is the additional material that's on here, the visor guard here, the extra screws and so on, and it's still lighter than the helmet had on here a little bit ago. I mean, it's
crazy.
Technology is just advancing more and more, and Bell's right on top of it.
The team actually wanted me to have the longer chin panel because it helps them hear me better on the radio. And honestly, it's just one of those things that we've added, not really knowing where it came from. So seriously, thank you. And I'm sure my whole team will thank you for it too, because they say that I'm not easy. But
I'm just amazed the team actually wants to hear him out. Well, let's close with Spence and Kyle talking about what I think could be a cool story. So Al told us his introduction to Bell was at 8 or 9 years old in karting, and now at a svelte 35 years old, you know, he's still
Thank
a proponent. What about you guys who've been, you know, perfect examples of the Mazda road to Indy, come up through the American open wheel scene, and you've been building your own legacy with the brand? I'm guessing you look to someone like Al and go, that's a pretty cool, essentially lifelong association. These things you're forecasting for yourselves as well?
Yeah, I sure hope so. My first ever karting helmet was a Bell as well when I was, seven.
Wow.
A white Bell, and we had I had a Michael Schumacher replica visor strip on it.
Nice.
And the Tic Tac and the Marlboro and the Shell.
Marlboro at 7 years old. I'm going to talk to your dad when we're done here, but okay.
Went away a little bit, but now I started wearing Bell again last season, and it's been, you know, a great experience. I've really enjoyed the helmet. You know, as soon as I put it on, it was extremely comfortable. Light was one of the first things I noticed as well. And, you know, the service that we get from everyone at Bell, you know, we get whatever we need. It's always prepped. It's always ready for us. So it's nice to be at the track and not have to worry about putting tear-offs on or a new visor if it's raining. You know, as soon as I go in the truck, it's already done. So that's really neat. And, you know, they're putting a lot of effort and resources into places like this here in Speedway, so it's you know, it's great to see the company, you know, kind of growing and being more in my life, which I'm very happy about.
So Kyle, I joked on a podcast earlier this week that one of the new services they're providing is Helmet Scents, so you can get vanilla, root beer, whatever you want, lavender.
Cowboy wants cotton candy.
Yeah, so that might be a thing, but tell me about having your helmet here, getting ready for the 500, and coming in and saying, all right, guys, these are the things that I'd like. I mean, often in the past, that was something left either to the team or the driver. Is there a level of comfort knowing that, again, with the relationship you're building here, it's almost, you know, whatever you need made to order ASAP?
It's been an amazing experience, and I'm probably the newest guy to the Bell family. This is my first year with them, and it's been so amazing. They've been so helpful and giving me whatever I need, whenever I need it. I couldn't be more grateful for what they've done. And like Jack said, with the, you know, the little chin pad or the chin piece, I mean, my team was struggling to hear me, and to hear the origin story of how that came about has been really cool. I just had to go in and say, yeah, I need a longer one. They're like, done, boom, swapped it out in a minute. So it's been really amazing, giving me whatever visors I want to match my new liveries and my helmet, because I've gotten a couple different helmet liveries now, so it's just been an amazing experience since I've been with them. Having them right there at the track in the garage, every day I come out and I'm like, where's my helmet? I'm like, oh, it's probably at Bell. I go over there and they're working on it and they got it ready to go for the next day. So I've just been completely surprised and in a good way at how hard they work. And knowing they have most of the drivers in the field, it's not like they have just my helmet to work on. They're working on a lot of helmets.
19.
And it's just an incredible effort. I'm very happy to be with them.
All right, last question then. If you could have had scented helmets, what would you want it to smell like, Al? What are we thinking?
Are you kidding?
You'd want beef, wouldn't you? You'd want steak-scented, and Marlboro-scented helmets.
My helmets were scented, and it wasn't fresh.
All right, Harvey, what about you? Come on. We've already got Sparkle Pony covered, so I mean, there's no way further down.
I don't know what the queen smells like. I just wanted to radiate the queen.
Oh, man. There you go.
That's weird.
That is.
There you go.
I'm feeling
elderly woman.
This month.
An elderly woman.
It just radiates home.
Spence, what's coming? What are we smelling in your helmet if Wheeler could bust that out?
How about roses?
Oh, you have a note.
There's some media training opportunity here. I was thinking vodka, but swing and a miss, Spencer Pigott. Did we figure out what yours would be there, Kaiser?
I do have a sweet tooth for cotton candy, and Spencer did say that. I've always kind of liked the smell of fuel. I know that's weird, and it's probably a bad one to have in the helmet when you're driving.
What kind of fuel? Because are we talking diesel?
Just racing fuel. I like at the go kart track. You smell the fuel. It's kind of a cool like
high
throwback.
Octane.
Yeah.
If it's one thing we've learned today, is that is the new definition of manly and cool.
I heard roses.
Well, I was going to say,
step this up, right?
I'll tell the story of the helmet being in fire in the helmet. You want fuel in the helmet. I don't know if we learned anything here, my friend, but you know we got time. They're young.
If you're talking about scents, okay, that reminded me of Daytona 24 hours.
Here we go.
6 a.m. in the morning. Foyt puts me in the car because it was a rush deal. I didn't get anything to eat.
Porsche 962.
Yep, Porsche 962. And so we're 2 hours stint, so 1 hour, and they come in for fuel and another hour. Came in for fuel right before the stop. Do you need anything? I go, I'm hungry. And so on my stop, they slide in on a pole, taped to a pole. They slide in a ham and cheese sandwich, okay, with mustard, okay, and they did it as a joke, okay? Well, they pulled the pole back, no sandwich. Okay? So I'm out there running. I took my gloves off, put them under my legs, started getting into this sandwich, okay? And then, I had to pull my helmet down. Well, that didn't work, so I pull it up and I'm driving, okay, and Foyt hears about what I'm doing, and he goes, I didn't pay you. He comes on the radio, I didn't pay you to eat, I paid you to drive, and I go, well, what lap time do you want, you know, because I'm hitting the number that they want. And so the crew, how Foyt found out about it, is the crew's talking on the radio, where'd the sandwich go? I said, I got it. What are you doing with it? I said, I'm eating it. And so for the rest of the race, okay, because mustard got everywhere. Oh. For the rest of the race, that 962 smelled like mustard. That was awful.
I mean, assuming you'd have been heel and toeing in a H pattern.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's not like we have now, just up and down on the steering wheel.
It was real.
Mowing down a ham sandwich. In a Porsche 962 in the high banks of Daytona.
I'm feeling a lot less manly.
And I ate the whole thing.
And he ate the whole thing.
I swallowed the whole thing, yeah. Took me about 6 laps or so.
All right. Well, we got to let these guys go. All I'm saying is, hopefully Gabby won't hear this, but if you get a chance on race day, stick out, you know, get that drink bottle going with a little sandwich taped in there.
This is a Daytona 24 hours. Okay. This is Indy, 500 miles. He's focused as you guys are.
We should do it just as an inside joke, and then we'll all laugh about it, but no one else will know what's going on.
Gabby, if you're wondering where the ham and cheese sandwich came from, it wasn't us.